more people that we came to talk about it, the more we realised that there's only one point of view that's being presented of the epoch of terror that we're living within, and that's the narrative presented by governments.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Sharon Weinberger, Executive Editor for News, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington, D.C. today, and joining us from London are Kathy Scott Clark and Adrian Levy, award-winning investigative journalists and filmmakers who worked as foreign correspondents and writers for The Guardian and The Sunday Times. They are co-authors of the new book, The Exile, The Stunning Inside Story of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in Flight, which was released last month. And calling in from New York is Murtaza Hussein, a journalist for The Intercept, covering national security, foreign policy, and human rights. ER listeners, we love hearing from you. If you have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. So I wanted to start off talking about the construction of the book. What was so amazing for me as I started to read it was the obvious access you had to the people, that the family members and the people around Osama bin Laden. Can you talk a little bit about the origins of the book and putting together and getting access to the sources?
I guess it all started shortly after Osama bin Laden was killed, and we are regular visitors to Pakistan and were there working with the army, in fact, doing a documentary in Waziristan. And I just kept thinking the wives and the kids are still here. They were being held by the ISI, the intelligence services, in legal detention. And I was just desperate to know what they had to say about their experiences, what had happened on the night he was killed, had they been with him all the way through, what did they think about 9/11. So gradually I kind of got close to them through a local journalist and eventually got to speak to them and to meet them. And that, I guess, was the beginning of the story. And from there, we then sort of said, well, we can't just do a kitchen sink drama. We need to kind of know a bit about Al-Qaeda as well. So we put together a list of who was still alive and not in Guantanamo and potentially accessible. And it was quite a short list, but we went from there.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. You talk in the beginning about how what differentiates the narrative we have about Al-Qaeda from other political movements, even in modern history, is the control around the source material, source materials that have been, for instance, captured by the Pentagon, by the U.S. military, and also control of the people themselves. So that presented quite a unique challenge for you as well, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the more people that we came to talk about it, the more we realised that there's only one point of view that's being presented of the epoch of terror that we're living within, and that's the narrative presented by governments. And because of the limitations of reporting and investigating and writing inside a prescribed insurgency, an inscribed terrorist outfit, if you want to call it that, like Al-Qaeda, it means that very few books have come from within it, and instead the prescribed narrative, the narrative of governments and analysts, is what you're left holding on to. But it's more than that. I mean, really, there've been some superb books to come out of the epoch of terror. I think of Lawrence Wright's Looming Tower, which I personally loved. And before that, Steve Cole's great work on the 1980s in Afghanistan, the first great big jihad. But all of those books are, largely speaking, police procedurals in the sense that they take the perspectives, not Lawrence Wright's, but certainly the others that have come out of the present epoch, take the perspective of the FBI and the CIA. And we've always wanted to see the other side, to, if you like, reconstruct Al-Qaeda's corner, see the view from their viewpoint.
But, I mean, another element of what you're talking about, I think, is as we just got further into the book and the research of it, was we discovered that so much material that was out there had been locked away and classified and not even properly gone through. I mean, most of the documents, I think a million plus documents that were recovered from Abbottabad, mainly on sort of memory sticks and hard drives, have never, ever been properly classified, read, indexed, and they're not going to be released at all. I mean, we've only had, I think it's a few hundred documents, letters from bin Laden have been released.
Right, and the documents that are available, including the trove captured by the US military in Iraq, were reclassified where the Pentagon refused to roll out funding to continue to place them on show at the National Defence University. So there was, Kathy's totally right, there was the inability to access source material, and a point we also make in the book that the prisoners that are held, the detainees that are held, are silenced and cannot themselves be interviewed. So we have a situation of an absence of documentation, an absence of primary history, an absence of protagonists who can describe the story. And so, yeah, those were, in fact, a lot of the the reasons, the our thoughts, the impetus behind creating the exile.
One last thing for me. I mean, there was also the kind of the very forthright media campaign on behalf of the American administration in terms of pushing their version of the story. So collaborating on Zero Dark Thirty, the movie, giving access to very senior people who'd been involved in the actual operation, and then censuring individual SEALs who went off and wrote books and did TV interviews because they had kind of like stepped outside the sort of the bounds of not speaking about it. So, I mean, there's double standards on all sides.
Let's talk for a second about what you did find. I mean, what was amazing for me in going through the book was in some ways it's a family history with the tales of the wives and the children. And let me actually turn to Murtaza for a second. Murtaza, you recommended this book as, you know, sort of really strongly to me, and it was a great recommendation. What struck you about the book that you felt it was so important?
I mean, Cornwall said earlier, it's just such a untold history of this period because, as I said, so much of what we know about this era is told from the perspective of the CIA or the FBI, the U.S. government, but it's narrated from the Al-Qaeda members and their families' perspective. And like to the title of the book, the period is about the exile that happened after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Most of the book takes place in that epoch. And this lives of people, Al-Qaeda members and their families in Iran and Pakistan is described in great detail in this book. And especially in Iran, this is a completely opaque government. We had no insight into their thought process or what those Al-Qaeda members and their family were doing there, what their lives were like. It really shined a light on a history which is completely untold. And I was actually curious. Some of the best parts of the book are interviews with the former religious leader of Al-Qaeda, Abu Hafs Mauritani, who lives in Mauritania now after having sort of escaped the post-9/11 dragnet. What was his motivation for speaking with you, and how eager were they to tell their story? Because it's quite an incredible story, which has never been told before.
He initially was not reluctant. I mean, he agreed to meet me quite quickly after I made an approach through a Mauritanian journalist, and I was very surprised that he would actually meet me, and I was quite worried about going over there because I didn't know anything about Mauritania. I'd never been there, and this is in the middle of all the kind of kidnappings and beheadings of journalists in Syria. But he gradually opened up. I mean, it took several trips. I went there three times and spent kind of a week on each trip. His motivation, I guess, was wanting to stay relevant and stay in the game and being arrogant and wanting to kind of place his name in history. Yeah, I mean, he's now living in Nouakchott with his family. There's not a lot happening, although he is a kind of a bit of a local celebrity there, and he speaks in the mosque and has a lot of visitors. But I guess he wanted to reach out to the world and tell his story. And since I've last seen him, he's now gone on Twitter and is being more and more active. He was slightly cagey at the beginning because he had done a deal with the Mauritanian government when he came back that he would A, speak to a US embassy delegation made up of, I think, almost certainly FBI or CIA people, and he would B, keep a low profile. So he's kind of gradually sort of re-emerged, and luckily we got in there at the beginning.
But I think there's also, from him and from others, a strong desire to retell their story through their own prism, through their own lens, and the feeling that they've been caricatured or even lambasted, poorly drawn in previous books. I mean, an extraordinary range of materials out there with the wrong names, the wrong family relationships, the wrong dates, the wrong episodes. Not only that, but as you pointed out, none of us really understood or knew the entire parallel kingdom of the entire parallel world of Iran. And yet here was a man who created the diaspora, the movement, the sanctuary, if you like, of Al-Qaeda family members and their council, the movement from Pakistan, Afghanistan into Iran. But also he lived then under the patronage of the Revolutionary Guards Council in Iran, along with the other imprisoned members of that caravan. And so it's extraordinary first-hand material, which totally changes our viewpoint as to what they did, how they did it, and who their patrons were.
Let's back up for a second. Tell us about that. Tell us about the time in Iran and about the quote-unquote tourist complex.
Well, the family, Osama's family, so one wife and lots of his children and in-laws and grandchildren. Mahfouz Abu Hafs Mauritani went first. He negotiated the sanctuary. He got together with Major General Qasem Soleimani, who is the head of Quds Force, who took control of the Al-Qaeda contingent and said, yes, come. And so he went first. Then some military council members of Al-Qaeda went next, including Saif al-Adel, who is still very active today, having been released last year. Straight to Syria. And then the family came and they gradually were sort of all put together and ended up in the main training facility of the Quds Force, which is in North Tehran near to the former Shah's palace, Sadabad Palace. And they were initially held in different blocks in sort of old military sort of recruits accommodation. And then everyone fell out with the authorities and they got better accommodated. It gradually got better and better. So by the end, by sort of 2008, 2009, they were living in what they called the tourist complex because each family had a separate apartment and they had a garden and there was a swimming pool and there was a gym and a doctor and a dentist surgery on hand. So it was quite nice by the end.
There's an interesting tiny little prologue to this, which is that when Mauritani goes over and he begins the negotiations with the Iranians, at that time it's no means certain that they'll offer sanctuary to Al-Qaeda. There's a period of conflict, there are reformists who are rising, and those reformists have reached out to the US. And there was a big delegation, for example, that was over at the Bonn conference, the conference that got Hamid Karzai in 2001, December, that got Hamid Karzai shooed in as the new president of post-Taliban Afghanistan. And Iran was the key activator in that and tilting really, really tilting forward towards the US. So when the Mauritanian turns up in Tehran, unbeknownst to him, he's come at the worst possible time, a time when Tehran wants to reach out and wants to form normalised relationships with America and with Europe to a certain extent. And yet, while he's there in January 2002, George W. Bush makes the Axis of Evil speech, the State of Union address, in which he lumps Iran in with the so-called Axis of Evil powers. And that creates a moment for the hardliners in Tehran. The reformists are seen as having achieved nothing. They've come through the bomb process. They've offered huge amounts of help, and yet nothing has been achieved. And so the Quds Force, the Revolutionary Guard, are in the ascendancy, and they embrace Al-Qaeda. They embrace Osama's family, the military council, as cards to play for the next decade to come.
You know, another part, too, is that half the story is based in Iran, but bin Laden and his family was in Pakistan during this time. And I noticed in the book, going through the footnotes, you had a lot of access to Pakistani officials speaking about that era. And I know that for many Pakistanis in the government, it was a very sort of bitter and cagey period. But they also opened up to you and told you their perspective of what happened. And it's always been a big question, how much did they know about the presence of bin Laden? What did you glean from those discussions and what they were trying to convey and what they did or didn't know about that period?
I think getting to talk to mainly generals was something that had taken a long time. I mean, we'd been working in Pakistan on and off for 20 years, so, and had written previous books in the region. So I think we had a kind of bit of a track record which got us the foot through the door type thing. But initially people were quite cagey and it took many. I mean, my passport has got something like 14 Pakistani visas in it from the last 3 years. It took quite a lot of effort to get people to talk sort of fairly candidly.
Yes, and it's a question of momentum building, you know, like one person talks and then they ring ahead to you know, to the next person, and that you build up this sort of unstoppable snowball effect where people don't want to be left out of the retelling of their own history or have someone else tell it for them. You know, there's quite a lot of concern and worry and backwatching that goes on there. And certainly, you know, contrary to what appeared before, and having got to nearly all of the director generals of the ISI and also having our own sources within the intelligence service and the traditional, more conventional military, a different kind of picture emerged, one of a more chaotic country where not everything is homogenized or unified. You know, the intelligence services are very, very disparate and fractionalized. They don't all operate in a top-down way. They're very dysfunctional. And, you know, the idea is laughable that there was some kind of Osama desk, you know, with a sign on it where, you know, there were guys in a red phone and they were creating policy on the hoof. You know, instead, we've described it as a ball of wool where you get retired officers. You're no longer actually sure if they're being paid by the military. They were with ISI, but now they're fully fledged officers working in jihad fronts in Pakistan that are allied to Al-Qaeda. And all of this makes it incredibly difficult to untangle relationships. But in fact, you know, in quite a few honest discussions, we heard descriptions by the ISI of how disappointed they were in their own efficacy. Their reputation vastly outstrips their efficacy.
I mean, when I eventually got to sit down with General Pasha, who was the head of the ISI at the time of the operation, he said I couldn't put his name in the book. I couldn't say that I'd interviewed him, although we had an interview. And it was just, it was quite clear. It was quite clear, and I hadn't already made my mind up, but it was quite clear from what he said. He had no idea. He really had no idea, and neither did General Kiani, the head of the army, that Osama was sort of sitting in his house less than a mile away from the Pakistan, the military academy in Abbottabad. And if you look at what they did, how they responded to the raid and the killing and the announcement by Barack Obama in Washington that Osama bin Laden had been tracked down to a major sophisticated city in within
town.
within sort of an hour and a half or however many hours drive from Islamabad. I think it was about more like three, but they just shut down everything. I mean, I had a really interesting couple of sessions with the head of ISPR, which is the basically the press office for the army and the ISI,
aka PSYOPs.
Yes, and General Athar Abbas, who had spent sort of the next 3 weeks just being, as he said, being bombarded by a million phone calls from news operators all over the world. He said it was an absolute nightmare because his phones were hot, and all of his deputies were looking at him to sort of make a decision as to what to say. And he kept texting Kiani and Pasha and saying, look, we've got to say something. We can't just sit here. And they wouldn't let him make a statement for 4 days. As they kind of went round mopping up and arresting everyone from the milkman to the baker to the neighbour to the first policeman on the scene in Abbottabad.
To the gardeners, to the tree cutters, to the journalists. I mean, nearly everybody in any way associated disappeared and either turned up dead or was exiled semi-permanently from the country. Their clear-up was ruthless and brutal, but everything that went before was appallingly amateur.
Well, let's talk about the 2011 raid for a moment. It's fascinating how you integrate the narratives. I mean, we have No Easy Day, the Navy SEAL sort of first-person narrative. We have different versions out there, and you combine it with also your own interviews. And in some cases, there are things that are hard to resolve, as you point out. What were the most surprising things or the things you found that either challenged or changed the narrative of what happened that day?
Well, there are some extraordinary things that came out. One of them, undoubtedly, was the fact that Hamza bin Laden, who's now emerged as the youthful voice and figurehead of resurgent al-Qaeda, one of Osama's sons, who's now made five or six statements behind the digital campaign We Are All Osamas. He had visited the house shortly before the raid, and he arrived to find everyone on tenterhooks, extremely paranoid. And his father, who'd been dying to see him and writing constantly, checking where he was, gave him dinner and then shooed him away. And it appears that he had left the house shortly before SEAL Team 6 arrived. And they arrived and initially reported that they had killed Hamza bin Laden. But in fact, he, his wife Mariam, and their two children were hot-footing it out of Abbottabad to safety in Waziristan, we believe. That was one surprising episode.
And then the person who was killed was the older brother,
Yeah, the
Khalid.
Person who died actually was Khalid, his older brother, not Hamza, as was declared. And the other thing that was astounding in the build-up to the raid itself was the fact that the Guardians, the Kuwaiti brothers, who had been responsible for looking after Osama, they actually had become fed up of their job, no longer wanted to be the babysitters.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, one of them was extraordinarily ill. Basically, had a nervous breakdown. The other one had developed a vicious form of cancer. And they'd served Osama in 2010 with an eviction notice. Their wives had put them up to it and said, we cannot stand this anymore. Get the guy out of the house.
the house guest you never wanted.
Yeah. Right, the house guest we never wanted.
The point they made to him at the time was, well, look, we started looking after you in 2002 when you had one wife and one baby, and there's now something like 20 people living upstairs.
Right, so Zama then triumphantly comes back to Amal and the other women in the house and says, I've done us a great service, we won't be evicted, and instead I've won an extension for the household and we can stay till after the 10th anniversary of 9/11 is commemorated. And so he gets this buy until the end of September, or the middle of September 2011. And of course, he's singing a dance about that in about February or March or April of 2011. And 4 weeks later, 3 weeks later, the raid will happen. So the pressures on the household were extraordinary. Certainly, the build up. And perhaps the third most gripping episode was the release of the family from the parallel kingdom of Iran, where they'd been left, and tracking with the letters the movement of the sons, the wives, through Waziristan. Saad bin Laden, he tragically was killed.
You're going back in time. That was 2008, 2009.
Yeah, I'm going back in time. Saad bin Laden would be killed in a drone attack. And then Khairiyya, one of Azama's favourite wives, would make her way into the house.
Just before the raid.
And what the correspondence shows us and what we know from our interviews is that everyone suspected that she was a dupe and that she'd been allowed out by the Iranians who were working with CIA to track her to the house in Abbottabad. And so on her journey, as she tracks through Waziristan, these letters begin to leave the house more and more frantically. Get your teeth checked, get your body checked. A listening device can be the size of a rice grain. The paranoia is building.
I don't think you can say that the Iranians were working with the CIA.
Well, no.
They were looking for an opportunity to get something with which to manoeuvre a better relationship with the Americans. Yeah.
So I was fascinated by the initial reference that you had in the book about, you know, the idea of a tracking device in a filling. I mean, is there any evidence that there was a tracking device on her?
Well, the family believed that there was. And, I mean, she's quite a lot older than he is, and he was. She was the most regular visitor to the dentists in the tourist complex and had big problems with her teeth and had a lot of work done. So I think that was kind of the source of one of the problems. And she, I think, in the letters she wrote to Azama once she was kind of on the move and on the way to him, she acknowledges that she needs to kind of just double check and go to a dentist in Peshawar, which is what she did, and just make sure that there's nothing in there. She'd have to have all her fillings taken out again and reset. So I think everyone was very worried, but the family remain quite angry with her because they feel that she should not have come, given that everyone was worried that there was some, she was bringing danger, yes, into Abbottabad, that she shouldn't have been selfish and determined in that she was going to come and meet and be reunited with her husband, whatever anybody else thought.
Just one final thought as well, just in terms of the question that you originally asked. The other thing that emerges is that, contrary to the narrative built subsequently, the idea of the lion in winter, the idea of an aging, greying Azama staring up at a TV set, possibly accessing pornography, as was written shortly after the raid, the idea of a dead calcified sclerotic movement, the image that you have inside the house is, after doing all of these interviews and reconstructing the period, is quite different. And we've described him really as being an engineer working in the bowels of the Titanic, in the sense that he's frantic. His communications...
Frantically busy.
His communications are enormous. He's producing volumes of letters. His political secretary is Khalid, his son, and they're writing and writing and writing. He's getting couriers to zigzag across Pakistan, etc., contacting all of the franchises, contacting the military shura, the fighters and strategists. And in fact, it's quite the opposite of the image portrayed shortly after his demise.
Now, one narrative you don't mention, I mean, at least I didn't see it, correct me if I'm wrong, is the sort of the counter narrative that came out through Seymour Hersh in the London Review of Books. So is that something that you just discounted, or how was your approach to that? The idea that he was essentially a prisoner of Pakistan and ISI, and that it was all sort of arranged ahead of time.
Well, when we first started researching the book, we didn't come at it with any kind of fixed position at all. I mean, but as a result of all the interviews we've done over all of the years, I just don't believe any of that.
Right.
I mean, I think also, you know, I'm a huge admirer of Cy Hirsch, and so I don't really want to
deal with
him as an individual. But I mean, I think, I feel that we tried to present a different vantage point. His sourcing on his story was a different kind of sourcing. It was American sourcing by majority with one Pakistan source who we have in common. And what we were trying to do was to get the story told from the people within the house, within the Shura, the council, within the religious and military parts of that, and then reach out to the broader diaspora of Al-Qaeda members and do that slowly over 5 years. And so I feel that we were coming at this with different methodology, a different approach, and we saw no evidence that he was captive, quite the opposite. I mean, Kathy and I described him being loaned a cloak of invisibility. That's the metaphor that we sort of came up with. Various jihad fronts that work very carefully with the deep state in Pakistan, the intelligence and military establishment, loaned him invisibility, kept investigators away, you know, shrouded him in this little snow dome inside Abbottabad. And he was not a prisoner. You know, he actually left the house on quite a few occasions, as far as we understand.
A few occasions.
Yeah. So it's quite the opposite narrative emerged, you know, to that one, certainly.
Let's talk for a moment about the rise of the Islamic State. You have this wonderful quote in the book about al-Baghdadi saying, quote, was a former policeman who had made ends meet before the U.S. war by repairing televisions and dishwashers really now more important than Osama bin Laden. How did al-Qaeda react to the rise of the Islamic State?
That quote relates to the predecessor to Baghdadi.
Oh, sorry. Thank you for the correction.
But yes, they were very worried because, and Osama was very cross. I mean, there's a whole series of letters that he exchanges with his deputy in the tribal areas in 2010, where he's saying, look, the Islamic State have gone ahead and they've the former policeman got killed, and then Baghdadi sort of seized the moment and the opportunity and pushed himself forward and became the caliph. And Osama was furious, and he's like, well, look, this is an organisation which was started by al-Qaeda. It belongs to us, and yet they're appointing sort of new leaders and going off on their own track. We need to get them back on side. So he sort of demanded a big biography and CV of Baghdadi. Who was he? Where had he come from? But I mean, they never really resolved that because Baghdadi really went off on his own. And then post Osama, he took money from Zawahiri, who took over al-Qaeda, and then basically tried to kill all of the al-Qaeda people in Syria.
He also offered huge bribes. I mean, there's extraordinary stories of him approaching Abu Qatada and Makdisi, two noted al-Qaeda-leaning jihad scholars in Jordan, and offering them $1 million to step on side, more than $1 million to step on side for Islamic State, for Daesh. And he did the same with the franchise in Yemen. They were offered $4 to $10 million to quit al-Qaeda.
And al-Shabaab.
And al-Shabaab as well to come. So they were trying to lubricate all these deals with this enormous slush funds and buy over the great figureheads of al-Qaeda to Islamic State.
And the slush funds were from where?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, obviously, they had access by that stage. They were actually an operating state physically, so they had access to oil revenues. They had access to the treasuries of the huge areas that they'd colonized. So, you know, I believe we could say that's petrochemical millions.
So, one thing I'd just like to say at this point is on that front, I mean, it became clear and interesting but alarming and frightening that this is all a business. Jihad is a business for these people, and they're all in different camps, and they're all looking, they've all got their eye on kind of where's the money coming from. We need to get the supporters to look at us and not someone else. We get the cash flows with that. The cash comes with that. And so when you were talking to people like Makdisi or Qatada, I mean, it's quite clear the whole thing is a business.
So how is the business doing today?
Well, this is such a fascinating state of play right now. I mean, people are talking right now as Islamic State loses control geographically, territorially.
But takes Tora Bora.
But, you know, yeah, as seems to be apparent, they seem to have their franchise in Afghanistan, as far as we understand it, has taken control of al-Qaeda's old redoubt.
Osama's old redoubt.
Osama's old redoubt in Tora Bora, the caves of Tora Bora. Islamic State, there's a lot lot of talk about many of its thinkers, ideologues and fighters merging with Al-Qaeda. It was raised originally as an idea by intelligence services in Iraq in April. And since then, we've been talking, Kathy has spent a long time talking with Makdizi and Qatada in Jordan, and lots of messages have been coming through Jordan suggesting that there may well be a new kind of hybrid organisation, Al-Qaeda Point 4, whatever we're on now, which contains elements of both organisations. I mean, Al-Qaeda is resurgent. They have never done better, and they've done it by being less cruel.
Yes, and they're using Hamza, the son who survived, who escaped before Abbottabad, the Abbottabad raid. They're using him as the kind of like the youthful fronting videos with his audio statements saying things like, "We're all Osama." And it's very interesting talking to his siblings about what he's doing now, and they're all very upset about it, and they're desperate.
Fearful for him.
Yeah. Desperate. Well, he's just had a baby with his wife, who is with him, and they just desperately want him to shut up.
I know that the book ends, I mean, before sort of the rise of Donald Trump and before the election, but could I ask you a little bit about that? How do you think Al-Qaeda views that, responds to it? Does it, I mean, how are they sort of playing it in their own interests?
Well, I mean, you know, that's such an interesting question, because these are massively finely tuned pragmatic and strategic decisions that are being taken on the ground. I mean, if you look alone at the way Iran has worked, Iran has been thinking in terms of decades. Iran has not been thinking in 3-year electoral cycles, you know, or 3.5 years before, let's say, someone begins campaigning for presidential. So the Quds Force, you know, they had a plan which they began to put into place in December 2001, and that plan was running right up until 2016. And so these finely tuned pragmatic decisions that are taken on the ground, I think, will withstand the sudden shocks and bolts that are thrown from DC. I think they probably welcome the chaos, because in that chaos, that we've seen through the mixed messages coming through with Saudi and Qatar and the isolation of Iran, etc. Within that chaos, there's more manoeuvring that can take place on the ground. And the reality on the ground is that everyone is far more pragmatic. Sunnis are together with Shias fighting. We have America backing forces it would never have backed before, even giving some support to Hezbollah when Hezbollah intervened in Syria. And now we see that Quds Force, the shock troops of the Shia superpower, were definitely working at a certain point with Al-Qaeda, a prescribed Sunni outfit. So these subtle little shifts and balances in the movements of power, I think they welcome the noise and chaos that's emanating from DC.
So final question, really to all three of you. I mean, will we see a resurgent Al-Qaeda?
I think yes.
Yes.
Murtaza?
I think it's unfortunately undeniable.
That's interesting. Well, I wanted to thank all of you for joining me here. The book is really wonderful. And more importantly, it's a page-turner, and a page-turner in a sense you don't expect, of learning about the family members and about some of the issues that drove the people within Al-Qaeda. Thank you for joining us on the ER, and please join us next time. You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Sharon Weinberger, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori. For more information about FP and to subscribe to the ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.